So this is recording.
Yeah.
And I'll stick it down there.
Alright. Okay, so the first thing I need from you is just present yourselves, say what you do, age, where you're from, things like that.
Alright.
Whatever you want.
Okay. My name's Mick West. I'm 46 years old. I live in Venice, California. I'm a debunker. I specialize in debunking the chemtrail conspiracy theory. I've got two websites, contrailscience.com and metabunk.org.
Okay. You're very known among the chemtrail believers, I don't know how we call them. What is the perspective they have of you? Or do you have any?
The chemtrail people seem to think that I'm some kind of government disinformation agent, that I'm being paid to do this. But really, I'm just doing it because it's a hobby of mine. I started out just because I was interested in contrails, because I was taking flying lessons at the time. And I saw the chemtrail conspiracy theory online, and I thought it would be something very interesting to write about.
Okay. I'm going to play the little, I don't know, you said it in English, but I think it's a devil advocate.
Devil's advocate.
Yeah.
Yes.
Say, they're saying it's impossible because, I mean, most of the time you're debunking now, that it could be a hobby and that in fact you're paid by the government to do that.
I'm actually retired. I made a reasonable amount of money in the video game industry. I part-owned a company called Neversoft, and we did the Tony Hawk series of video games, so we did very well there. And so I retired quite a few years ago, and I've just been having a lot of spare time since then, so I don't need the government to pay me. I'm just doing it because I find it fun and interesting.
Okay. What's the purpose for you to do that?
Well, first of all, it just started out as something that was just a hobby. It was just interesting to do. But I think it's becoming increasingly important to show that conspiracy theories are incorrect, because they're getting in the way of dealing with real problems. There's real problems with climate change and pollution, but people aren't addressing them because they think the chemtrails are happening, and so it distracts away from real problems. So I think if I can show that chemtrails are not real, it will help more people move on and actually address these other problems.
So what do you think, basically, if you have a few comments to say about chemtrails for you, what are chemtrails?
Well, people think that the trails that they see in the sky are not normal contrails, and they are chemtrails. But really, when you get down to it, there's no real evidence that they're anything other than normal persistent contrails. And there's no real evidence that they've changed over the last 20, 30, 40 years. All that's happened is there's a lot more of them now because, for a variety of reasons, but mostly because there's more traffic. So it's really based on a misunderstanding of what contrails are. People think that contrails disappear quickly, but really it depends upon the atmospheric conditions, and people are just aren't aware of that. They just haven't paid attention to it before, and now they do, and they find something suspicious. But really, if you look into it, there isn't really anything there.
And so you absolutely don't believe in any of the evidence over there? The things they're saying or the possibility.
Yeah, I don't believe there's any evidence that what they are saying is true. Now, of course, that doesn't mean it's not possible. It just means that there isn't any evidence for it. So there's no real reason to believe it. You could suspect that maybe the government might be doing something in a way that's not leaving any evidence, but that's kind of meaningless because you could say that about anything. So you've really got to look at what is the actual evidence and does it actually hold up? And when you get down to it, it really doesn't hold up.
And why do you keep doing it? I mean, those people, most of them, they are very convinced that those chemtrails exist. So what's your purpose of trying to debate with people who just don't want to die?
Well, it's true. The people who are convinced, they're not going to change their minds. But it's the people who aren't entirely convinced who is really what I'm aiming at. When I have a debate with someone who's a hardcore believer, a true believer, they're not going to change their mind. But someone else who's listening to me giving these explanations, they might then change their minds, or they might not fall into the trap of thinking that chemtrails are real, because I'll give them an explanation as to how they're actually just contrails. So it's these marginal people who I'm really aiming my debunking at, not the hardcore believers.
And when you are talking with the hardcore believers, what are the evidence that they're bringing you up? What are they saying to prove?
there's a variety of things. And the first one, the simplest one, is the claim that contrails should not persist because they would evaporate, like your breath evaporates on a cold day, you breathe out, you can cloud it, it disappears. But that basically is just a misunderstanding of the science behind contrails, because contrails aren't really like your breath. They don't evaporate because they freeze, and then they persist if the air is ice supersaturated. The other bit of evidence that quite often gets brought up is the tests, the chemical tests that people make of things like water or air or the soil or rain. Now, these tests, they're generally testing for things like aluminum, and aluminum is the most common metallic element in the Earth's crust. It makes up about 7 or 8% of the ground directly underneath us. And so you find it everywhere because it's like in the dust in the air, mineral dust from soil and dry soil gets in the air. So you find aluminum everywhere you look. And these tests that they've done have really been very, very badly done. For example, when they're testing water, instead of actually testing water from a clear source, they've taken sediment from the bottom of a pond and tested that dirty water, which contains a lot of soil, a lot of wind-blown dust, and they found aluminum naturally. So if you go through each of the tests that people have claimed to be evidence and look at what's actually being done, you find it really doesn't indicate anything other than just normal environmental aluminum that you would find pretty much everywhere.
So basically, when you watch the movie from Michael Murphy movies, and when he's bringing this evidence of aluminum in water, for you it's not.
The test that he has in that movie, I have a copy of it here. It says right here on the test, it says pond sediment and sludge. And then this is the test that he uses in the movie, saying that this is a test for water, and he gives this high result here, 375,000 parts per billion, which sounds really high. But for muddy water, that's actually slightly low. You would actually expect a little bit more than that because it's muddy water. So there's nothing at all unusual about this particular test. And there are other tests that have similar problems to that. There's tests where he has tested the dirt that's been left behind when water in a puddle has dried up. He tests the little bit of dirt you find in the bottom of from an evaporated puddle of water, and then said, "Yeah, this is very, very high levels for water." When it's really soil, like there's a note on this test here. It says these readings are tens of thousands of times the maximum limit for water, but it says right here he's testing soil. So they're testing the wrong things in the wrong way. So it's not at all unexpected that they'll find these high numbers because there's aluminum everywhere, but they're doing the tests wrong.
Another question is about the patents. Patents exist ensure that chemicals could be induced into by jet planes into atmosphere. So this is something that exists, that we can see. It's official. Don't you think that it could be a possibility that this induction of chemicals into the atmosphere could be already done?
Like I said before, it's possible to do it. It's not rocket science to spray something out of the back of the plane. But patents aren't really evidence that something is being used. It's evidence that someone has realized that maybe sometime in the future someone might want to use this, and so they patent it so that they own the rights to it, so if that need ever does come up, then they will be able to make money from it. For example, here's a patent for a house on the moon. Now, there are no houses on the moon, and yet this is an official United States government patent that is for a house on the moon, and it doesn't mean anything. It just means someone thinks that one day we might have houses on the moon, so I'll patent it so I can make money out of that. And a lot of the other patents that they bring up are for silly things, like this one here you've probably seen. This is a thing called a powder contrail generator. It's what it is, it's a towed target that gets towed behind a plane, and people practice shooting down planes by shooting at this towed target, and they have this stream of powder that comes out of the back that is makes it visible so people can shoot at it at high altitude. But people use these patterns, these long lists of patterns, as evidence when they really aren't evidence at all. They're just things that have the word contrail in them or have the word spraying in them. Or they're patterns for some type of geoengineering that might be done in the future, but it's not being done now, like there's no houses on the moon.
You're saying it's not being done now, but when you say it could be done, okay, but when you say, what makes you say that it's not being done now? What makes you say that?
Because, right.
Well, of course, you're right, it could be done in the future.
Yeah.
What makes you say that it's not done now?
There's a number of reasons. One is the state of geoengineering research right now is in a very preliminary stage. If you read what the geoengineers are discussing online, they're discussing what might happen if we do this and what the side effects might be if we do that, or various different techniques. There's like 30 or 40 different ways they might do it, all these different types of things. So to suggest that they are actually doing something does not tally with the actual science. They're still in these very, very preliminary stages. They don't know what's going to happen. And if you read about it, read what they're saying, they're actually very worried about what might happen. And most of the geoengineers there, most of the people in geoengineering research, do not want geoengineering to happen. They're researching it mostly so that we won't do it, so that we'll be able to form some kind of regulatory framework so we can say what should or should not be done. And so we'll be aware of what the dangers of geoengineering are. But because the research is at such a low, low level, the chances of someone actually doing it secretly are just ridiculous, because they don't know what they're doing. They'll be just randomly throwing things in the air. It would be just insane to do.
But you agree with me that they already done that during the war for other purposes. They already, you know, threw things out of in the air. Without really knowing the consequences of that.
Well, you could say we did that with pollution. Like when we first built power stations, we didn't know exactly what was going to happen with all the sulfates, and then we ended up with acid rain. So yes, we put things in the air, but it's not a good idea to put things in the air if you don't know what you're doing.
Mm. But that doesn't mean that it's not done.
Absolutely.
So I would say it's not an evidence to say that a patent exists, but it's not an evidence that they're not doing it because they don't know what to do. Or what they're doing.
It would indicate that it would be very unlikely that they would do it. Like, what reason do they have to do something if they don't know what they're doing, and they don't know if it's going to work, and they don't know what the side effects are going to be? There's no reason for them to be doing it secretly.
We've been talking about aluminum in the water and Murphy's movies. Mm. Did you see the movie?
Yes, I did.
Did you like it?
It was an interesting take on the subject, but it was a good source of things to debunk, so in that sense, I liked quite a lot.
So for you, it's clearly, just to take back the question, you already kind of answered, but it's not, the results are clearly not an indication of the sprain. There's no link for you between what they found in the water or in the soil and spraying.
Yeah, really what they should do is try to find some correlation between spraying, what they think is spraying, and then things falling out of the air. But all they have is a few random tests here and there. It doesn't really show anything. And almost certainly they're just finding dust, basically. What you would expect to find in the rainwater. Aluminum has always been found in rainwater. You can look at rainwater tests going back to the early parts of the century, and they find it's mineral dust, basically, and they use it to determine where dust has come from. There's dust blowing in from the Sahara to Florida. There's dust blowing from China to California. There's dust blowing around within the United States. Mm. The Sahara affects Europe. There's dust everywhere. You know, just the dust that's from the dry soil in my yard contains aluminum. So
because it's coming from the soil.
Yes, the soil itself, like garden soil. In California, the soil is actually quite high in aluminum. It's nearly 10% aluminum. Because in the form of minerals like aluminum oxide and aluminum silicates. So there's an awful lot of aluminum in the soil, and so you get an awful lot of aluminum in the air. And on every surface, if I was to wipe that table down out there, you would get aluminum in the dust in quite a high percentage. And if I was to set a basin out there to collect rainwater, which is what they do a lot of the time, the dust that settles on that basin before it rains is going to contain aluminum. And when the rain falls, the rain is falling through dust in the air, it picks up aluminum, and that ends up in the sample. And it varies a lot because it depends on what the weather has been like. Was it sunny? Has there been rain? Has there been, you know, wind blowing dust in the air before or not? So you get these very variable peaks of aluminum.
So one of the point of the chemtrailers is saying that aluminum and barium and strontium and other kind of metals are in those trails. The best thing to debunk this thing would have been to send a scientist up there and, you know, make analysis and say there's nothing, or there's something, if there is, but there's nothing. Why is it not done? Why scientists are not just going up there and proving that it's just not done?
Because it would cost money, and there's no real reason to do it. The only people who really believe the chemtrail conspiracy theories are not mainstream scientists, and they're not people who generally have, you know, lots of spare money to spend on doing things like this. And to actually do it accurately, you would have to do an awful lot of tests, because it's almost certainly the first times you go out there, you'll just find normal trace amounts of whatever's in the atmosphere or just contamination. You have to be very, very careful when testing for aluminum, because there's so much everywhere. My body is probably covered with very, very small parts per billion of it, and that ends up getting in test tubes, and then you've got to have the chain of custody. So it's quite complicated, and there's no motivation for scientists to disprove something like this. It's like saying to a scientist, why don't you try to disprove ghosts or something like that? Yeah, some people actually do that. But
except that there's a pattern of the possibility of doing that, and there's no pattern of having ghosts in your house.
Oh, I think if you look, you might, there's certainly patterns for things like ghost detectors.
Yeah, so there is no interest to do that for scientists.
It's not so much there's no interest, it's really that there's no evidence. Like, you have to start out with evidence of something before you then go on. You can't just randomly say, well, perhaps there's cheese on the moon. We should send a probe to the moon to see if it's cheese or not. You have to have some evidence as to whether these trails actually are any different to normal contrails. If they look like normal contrails and they act like normal contrails and they're not historically any different to the older contrails, then why would you? Just because a bunch of people on the internet have been saying that they think it's different from how they remember it when they were young, and because they've been doing tests for aluminum that have shown what is really just normal levels of aluminum on the ground, there's no reason to do it.
So what would be for you an evidence, without going up in the sky because it's very expensive, what would be an evidence?
I would need to see some kind of distinction between what is a normal trail and what is a chem trail. If someone could demonstrate what the difference was, then that would indicate there's something to go on. But because they look exactly the same as normal contrails, there's really not much more to go on after that. You could then say, like, you know, maybe if they demonstrated high levels of aluminum in the water, then you've got to say, where is that coming from? Now, if they could, like I said earlier, if they could find a correlation between planes flying over and then aluminum appearing on the ground, that would be evidence.
If someone, for example, wouldn't be a scientist because they're not interested for the moment, would go up there and try the best to take some air directly from the trail and be able to analyze it, this person would find something, would that be some kind of beginning of evidence, or it wouldn't be enough for you?
It depends what they actually find and how rigorous the tests were. If you go up there and you just take like three or four samples and you find like aluminum, a little bit of aluminum in one and nothing in the other, it doesn't really mean anything. It could be just environmental aluminum. It could be very, very small amounts of aluminum. It could be like a problem with your testing procedure. It could be a problem with the containers that you use. It could be a problem with the way you wash the containers out in the first place. It could be something later down in the chain of custody when you take that container in to be tested. If you're just testing air, that's an extraordinarily small amount of air that you're going to be testing. If you just take a container out there, if you have something going through a filter, then you've got to make sure you've got to have appropriate controls and a reasonable number of them to make sure it's not just some kind of anomaly that was already there on the filter, or we got onto the filter at a later stage. So if there was a rigorous scientific study that showed these things, then yes, that would be interesting. That would demonstrate perhaps that there is, you know, something in the air, or maybe even something coming out of the engines. But just taking one or two samples and finding a few little peaks here and there probably isn't going to indicate very much, because you would expect to find some kind of variation. You have to do it a large number of times.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, because that means that we would need scientists to go there, but the scientists don't want to go there. So it's kind of really hard to find a way to find this evidence, if evidence.
It's like, say, you had a theory that there were unicorns in Africa. No.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like the basic problem is there isn't the evidence, there isn't the reason to test the trails in the first place. It's like if someone said they saw a unicorn in Africa, would you then start organizing expeditions to go to Africa? You'd have to have a lot more evidence about the unicorns being seen in Africa before you start organizing an expedition, months-long expedition into darkest Africa to look at these unicorns. And it would cost quite a bit of money to do a really comprehensive study of aircraft exhaust. And if there really was this big conspiracy of people spraying things out of the back of airplanes, why are they going to let you go up there and sample the planes? They would have the government watching you, and they would switch the planes out, and they wouldn't spray when they knew you were following them. So it's kind of a self-defeating thing, because it's not going to prove anything if you find nothing, and it's very unlikely that you're going to find anything of significance. It would be interesting if you did, but
what did the Cape Trader tell you when you tell them what you're telling me now?
Well, first of all, they tell me that they ask me how I sleep at night and how much I get paid. And then they basically tell me that they remember trails being differently when they were young. This is the main thing that's behind the chemtrail conspiracy theory. It's not really based on the tests, the aluminum in the ground. It's based on people having a different recollection of the trails when they were young. But people's memories are very fallible. People don't remember very much, really, about when they were young. And there's a lot of people who do remember the trails looking exactly like this. If you ask people in Los Angeles, like here, for example, when they first noticed the trails, you'll see a lot of them will say 2011 or 2012 or 2009, because they've just seen Michael J. Murphy's film. Once you get primed for these things, you start noticing them. Mm-hmm. But then you ask other people and they say, oh yeah, I saw it back in 1999, because they heard about it on the radio. Or you'll hear other people say, oh, I saw them back in the 70s. I love watching the skies, because they just happened to notice them back in the 70s. But really, this is the main thing that underlies the whole conspiracy theory. It's not the chemicals. It's people's faulty recollections of what the skies were like.
We're going to come back after the question about history. He told you that he wanted you to read some quotes.
Yeah,
after.
Yeah.
We're going to do that after. Just personally, I want to, because you're really implicated in this field. And just personally, why do you feel the need to be so much into it? Why do you do it so personally?
Well, I don't really take it that personally. It's just it's become my hobby, so I spend a lot of time doing it. You know, some people spend a lot of time making model train sets, but I spend a lot of time debunking chemtrails. But increasingly, like I said earlier, I think it's an important thing to do, because it is distracting away from the real issues. Like in the same way that issues like 9/11 truth, people who think that the 9/11 towers were a controlled demolition, that's distracting away from the real issues of politics, like the corruption and lobbying, or why we went into Iraq. People, they focus on these outlandish ideas like chemtrails or controlled demolition of 9/11, and that just basically takes all of their energy away from real issues. And it's almost like, almost it could be a conspiracy where the powers that be are letting people spend all their energy on these silly things when they could be actually making a real impact in the world. Like chemtrails distracts from global warming. 9/11 distracts from corruption in politics, because people think there's big things, we can't handle the other things.
And do you get positive feedback from your work?
Yeah, I do. Quite a lot of people write and thank me for helping them see what's going on or being able to explain it to their friends or relatives. I get a lot of negative feedback as well from people who just think I'm shill. But yeah, I do. I get lots and lots of people who are very funny, very useful.
And technically, what is the process of debunking? How do you work? What is your research? How do you proceed to do that?
Well, yeah, debunking is really about focusing on the individual claims behind a theory. Like, you don't say, I'm going to debunk chemtrails. You say, what is the evidence? And you break down the bits of evidence, like these chemical tests, for example. And then you look at them in depth and you see what should be going on here. What does this actually mean? What actually happened? There's another one of these tests, for example, which seemed quite suspicious on the face of it. It was a test of some snow, which seemed like it had very high levels of aluminium. But then you look into it and you saw that the date of the snow was in July. You thought, how did they find snow in July in California? And it turned out it was on the top of a mountain, and it was this snow that was left over from the previous winter. It was dirty. It was covered with this red dirt, which was just aluminium. And you've got to really dig into these individual things. The problem with a lot of conspiracy theories is that they spread it out. So there's this thing, what about this, what about this, what about this, what about this? And you've got to take each one of those individual things and drill down until you hit the bottom, and then you can explain exactly what's that, and then you can take that thing and you can remove it from the theory. But conspiracy theorists generally just want to just jump straight to the next thing, so you've got to take each one in turn and go in depth on that individual thing, and then hopefully what's left is something that will show you what is real.
Okay, do you know Russ Tanner?
Yes, I know of him.
What do you think about the guy?
Well, he has some strange ideas. Like, he claims that he can smell chemtrails within a few minutes of the plane flying overhead, which is basically physically impossible because of a plane at 30,000 feet spraying out some kind of aerosol. It's going to take many, many hours, if not days, for it to come down to the ground. So his basic understanding, I think, of how the atmosphere works and how chemicals work, I think he's kind of flawed. And other than that, though, he basically has the same kind of theory about chemtrails as most of the other people do. But that one thing, I think, just stands out as being rather telling as to how well he understands what's going on.
Okay. Let me check, because I'm asking questions that are not on paper. And then... So we talked about the science is not going isn't it unscientifically to claim that we're not sprayed while not having a proof either? Just a question. Did you answer that? No.
What was the question?
Is it unscientifically to claim, or unscientifical to claim that we're not sprayed while not having a proof either? I mean, you say that they have no proof.
Yeah, I'm not claiming that we're not being sprayed. I'm just claiming that there's no evidence.
Yeah, maybe not you, but some scientists are saying no.
They're just expressing that it seems ridiculous, which, in addition to there being no evidence, it does kind of seem ridiculous. Like I explained earlier, with why would people do geoengineering if they don't know if it would work? Mm. Why would they randomly spray things in the air?
Yeah. They're saying it's ridiculous, but at the same time, as I said before, those patents, even if it doesn't exist, are there.
Yeah.
So the question, for me at least, I'm very skeptical too, but the question doesn't seem ridiculous when we know that the patent exists.
So the thing about the patents is you don't know if that patent works. Just because something is patented doesn't mean that it'll work. This house on the moon, you don't know if it's actually practical. You don't know if it's going to work or if it's going to leak or if it's a sensible thing or not. Someone has just come up with a patent because they know in the future we're going to do this type of thing. So I'll say, well, spraying aluminum oxide, that sounds like it'll work. So I'll patent spraying aluminum oxide. That's what they do, and maybe it'll work out. But they've no idea.
I agree with that view. But many scientists are, maybe probably making fun of it or taking it for something ridiculous.
Yeah.
I wouldn't find ridiculous a house on the moon. It's patented. It's it could be possible to make. Yeah, but the question is fair. It doesn't mean that it's done, but...
You would find it ridiculous if someone told you that there were houses on the moon.
The what?
So if someone told you that there are houses on the moon, you would find that ridiculous because there's no evidence of houses on the moon.
But on the other side, I wouldn't say that. Maybe I wouldn't be as far as you do. Right. I wouldn't say that. I would say I need evidence, but I wouldn't find it ridiculous. I would say, show me that there is a house on the moon.
Right, but there are other patents that are even more ridiculous than houses on the moon. There's a patent for giving birth, which involves strapping a woman to a table, spinning around really fast until the baby pops out.
Doesn't exist. It's not fun. No, what I mean is probably in the future it could be done or it's not done.
Yes.
It's just the way it's dealt with by the scientist community.
Right, but I think that's because the scientific community, they know what the state of the science is in climate research and in geoengineering research. They know that we're at the very, very early stages of understanding what would happen if we were to mess with the atmosphere. And so they know that it's a ridiculous idea to do now. They also know that it might be a sensible idea to do many years in the future, or hopefully not at all, if we can manage to fix the climate by reducing carbon emissions. So from their perspective, it seems silly, because they just simply know where we are at. They understand that there really isn't any good scientific basis to actually do it at the moment.
To your knowledge, who is the best scientist who could be able to talk about the phenomenon?
David Keith and Ken Caldera are two of the best, and I think Alan Roebuck is another one, but David Keith, I think, is the best. I know you've talked to Ken. Did you talk to David Keith already?
No. Ken Caldera, we talked.
Ken has stated many times that he's against geoengineering. He doesn't want to do it. And he's one of the leading researchers. He knows exactly what the state of geoengineering research is, and he knows that it would be silly for someone to just go and try doing geoengineering now because we don't know if it'll work or what the side effects are. The way the chemtrail theorists get around this is So Ken Caldera knows that it would be silly to do geoengineering because the research isn't there, we're not at that stage. But the chemtrail theorists say that the people who are in power are insane psychopaths who would just try it because they think they'll get away with it, which I think is a ridiculous way of putting things. Like there's no reason why the people in power would risk destroying the entire planet just so they can make it a little bit cooler. There's just no evidence behind, you know, any need to do immediate geoengineering right now.
Okay. I think we stop here and we go to the office.
Okay.
And there we're gonna read the statement or the quotes you took, and probably you can give me a little bit more about the history of the phenomenon.
All right.
I'm interested to know. Because one of the comments they're giving is that it's a new phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
which is not...
No, it's not new at all. You know, it's been going on since the 1920s.
Okay, so let me go for it.
Okay.
I'm going to take a little time just to put the cameras again. Are you okay with the question so far? It's okay? I'm not too aggressive. No, me, with you.
Like no more questions. Shall I just keep this?
Yeah, you can keep it with you. Just. Really? Wow. It's from 1965.
Right.
Can I make a copy for my wife?
Sure. You can take
it. Where can I find it? Can I take it?
Oh, you just,
or I can make a copy, or can I find it?
Write the number down. It's just...
Hello? article, but I don't have any evidence that this is done.
Yes.
That would be bummed.
I think it's on Google.
How's it called?
Apparatus. Let's just see if so. Maybe let's type a number and it'll come in.
Oh.
3216423. Yeah, you can just Google the patent number.
Here. Drop my wife and what's the video game you were talking about? You made?
It's this one. Skateboarding game.
When did you make that?
Oh, that was
long time ago?
Yeah, in the 90s, late 90s. Then we did that for a few more years.
But how does it work? The industry? You were more like
yeah, we were like an independent developer.
Okay.
And then the company got acquired by Activision.
Okay. Can I move this a little bit?
Yeah.
You're gonna use the screen in the middle, right?
Yes.
You already have the sequence that Matt just gave you. Or the little video. Did he give you a sequence?
Yeah, no, I have the video somewhere. Where is it? Did you want me to speak over it, or whilst it was on the background?
Yeah, I'm going
to
tell you how we do it.
This one starts up with the Memphis Belle footage. Uh-huh.
She's a young retired, huh? Lucky you.
Yeah, I was lucky. Video games.
You're making awesome things now,
huh? Yeah.
The game I don't play, but when I see it, it's impressive.
Yeah, the technology is
technology maybe
advanced a lot.
Yeah. It's not gonna work, this one has to be there.
No, not really. It's rainy.
family comes to visit, and the weather is a lot nicer here.
Oh yeah.
Is it moving a lot? Is it a quiet neighborhood?
It's fairly quiet, yeah. It's nice. There's a few busy streets at the other end, but we're kind of in between them, so it's not too bad. Nice set of lenses.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
Need a 50 for my lens shelf.
It's a 400?
No, it's more. It's 500. Just a second. Oh, nice. There's a 50 there if you need a 50.
It's not bad. That's nice. I have one, but I didn't take it. It's too heavy. I have more, but crowding is crowding.
Yeah.
You make a lot of pictures?
Yeah.
It's one of my other hobbies.
No, I'm taking photographs of planes.
I am with the 500.
Yeah.
Good pictures.
Yeah. Especially with LAX just down the road. There.
Is there a place where I can film planes from at the airport?
Yeah.
There's two places, not actually at the airport, but there's one place just below the landing, part of the north runway, and then there's another part that's like on a hill on a road just to the south of the main runway.
But from the airport building, there's nowhere where I can take pictures or
I think
time lapses, things like that.
Oh, right. yeah, because you don't have a car, so...
No.
No, because you can't really get into the departure areas of the terminals. You could get a taxi to take you to the in and out. They would know where that is. It's just it's a burger place just before the flight, so the landing area. I could show you where it is on the map. Yeah. Observation deck right in the middle of the airport, but I've never been to it. It's on top of the restaurant.
There is?
Yeah, it's this...
And the round thing?
This strange restaurant with the big things, but I'm not sure
if
it's open thing. Or if... I've never used it.
Since I'm there.
Yeah. Because they renovated that for the past few years, so... But In-N-Out Burger is the most famous place. Are you just going back to the airport after this?
Yeah, I'm going to just
a flying visit.
Came in yesterday, flying again to Houston today.
You're doing a different thing there.
Interview of Mr. Mees, Pat Mees.
All right.
And then go to Florida. That's for another project.
Patrick Minnis, he knows a lot about contrails and the chemtrail theory.
You're a great scientist, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. So here, let me check my questions. Number 5, I think. It's just going to be that. Yes, the phenomenon of man-made clouds by jet planes is new one. Is that true? Is that true? So it would be good if what we can do here is if you can watch the first archive, I think it's 1940, and we can already do the like read the comments for the quotes you took.
This film that you sent?
Yeah, this one. And just read the...
There's no sound. Yeah, it's only headphones. Where do we start it?
Clouds produced by jet contrails has been mainly recorded since the 1940s and is not new. Peter M. Kuhn wrote in a scientific study in 1970, the spreading out of jet contrails into extensive cirrus sheets is a familiar sight. Godfrey C. said that during hunting trips to the Colorado Rocky Mountains, he'd seen blue skies clouded over by jet contrails. Allott said he'd lived in Colorado all his life without ever seeing jet contrails form clouds.
Here is you can just, I think that's what he asked me to read, and if he asked you, I don't know if he told you that.
Yeah, it wasn't clear exactly.
So yeah, he wanted me to, you to, those are your quotes, right? Well, that's not your quotes,
no,
but you're using them, right?
Yeah, the things that I, yeah.
So he wanted me to read that, but okay, I told him it was a bad idea, but he really wanted it, so... that's exactly what the woman is saying, but
right.
That's for the movie. It would be better if you agree with them, of course.
No, I mean, I do, because this is a classic explanation from 1970.
So it will be the two first one.
Yeah. This one here is is kind of showing that one person sees contrails and the other one doesn't.
Exactly. So the idea here would be for you to comment that, because some people are saying none and some people are saying yes, and there it would be good if you could comment what you think. And then the last one is in the 90s. Cloud cover by jet planes started to increase. People are saying that.
Yeah,
that's one.
I wouldn't agree with that one though, because it didn't really start to increase in the 90s.
So if you can maybe can not read it, but explain what's your point of view about that. So for the two first ones, just read them and that's all, and then the two last ones, just if you can comment.
Right.
And I'm gonna be let me check. Yeah, it would be good if I see here, and you can look at the computer just like if you were reading, or maybe you were reading them, and then if you want to talk to me, you can talk to me and look at me.
Okay,
you can go from the computer.
Yeah,
you can read that and then look at me.
This is the actual paper where it came from.
So let me check if we're on. If you look at me, let me if I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's not bad. Okay, and you go back to the computer.
Okay. Well, should I have this on, or do you want something else on?
No, it's good. It's good. Yes. Okay.
So, yeah, here we go.
So, yeah, you can go ahead with the two first one.
All right. So, in this 1970 paper by Peter M. Kuhn, he says, the spreading out of jet contrails into extensive cirrus sheets is a familiar sight. Often when persistent contrails exist from 25,000 to 40,000 feet, several long contrails increase in number and gradually merge into an interlaced sheet. So this shows that contrails have been doing exactly the same thing since the 70s and before, and it wasn't at all unfamiliar back in the 70s. And people don't have the same perceptions of contrails. For example, in 1971, there was a congressional hearing on a new type of jet plane, and people's concerns were that it might increase contrail cover. And somebody at the hearing said, Godfrey, said he'd seen on hunting trips to the Colorado Rocky Mountains blue skies clouded over by jet contrails by 9:30 in the morning. And this was in 1971. However, someone else on the committee, a senator, Allott, said he'd lived in Colorado all his life without ever seeing jet contrails form clouds. So it just shows that there's this completely different perception depending on whether you're actually paying attention or not. Lots of people in LA never even really notice contrails, and lots of people notice them all the time just because they're actually looking for them.
About the 1990s, we can take that and tell me why you're not totally agree. You don't totally agree with what it says there.
Let me just say that. Another point I was going to make. All right. So. Jet traffic has been increasing steadily since the 1950s.
It didn't really have a particular jump in the 90s. It's been smoothly increasing. It's been getting more and more intense since the 1950s, 1960s. In the 70s and 80s, it really started going up a lot more. But it wasn't a sudden increase. It's still been this very gradual increase. But there's a number of reasons why there's a lot more contrails now than there were before. The first reason is that there are a lot more flights. There's simply more planes going from one place to the other. The second reason is there are a lot more routes or routes between individual cities, especially between the smaller cities. When jet traffic started, the traffic was mostly between these big hubs like Chicago and Los Angeles and San Francisco. So if you had to fly from San Diego to San Francisco, you would fly first to LA and then you would fly to San Francisco. So in the hub cities where most people live, there was very little overflight. And then when you get more regional jets, like what happened in the 80s and 90s, there's suddenly all these places that didn't have traffic over them where you're getting traffic that wasn't there before, and so people suddenly start to notice them. Then there's a few other things. There has been an increase in the number of regional jets that are being used, which are just small jets. And before, those routes might have been done by planes with propellers, which didn't fly as high, so they wouldn't leave contrails. And then there was a change in the vertical separation between planes. It was originally 2,000 feet, and it got changed because of improved navigation to 1,000 feet, which means you could pack a lot more planes into the upper altitudes where contrails form. And then there was also a change in the 80s and 90s where jet engines themselves changed, and they became much more efficient because they use high-pass turbofans. They have a cooler exhaust, and the cooler exhaust means it's a bit more likely for a contrail to form because there's a wider range of conditions that they can form in. So all these things together have increased the number of contrails that appear in the sky, but it hasn't really been a sudden increase. There's a few things that happen quickly, like the reduction in the separation, but overall, it's been an increase in the number of routes and the traffic. And the reason people think that it's sudden is that they've suddenly started looking for contrails in the sky. They once you hear about this theory or you notice them for the first time, then you start seeing them everywhere, just because your mind is primed to look for them.
Okay, good. This is good.
Yep.
There.
Yeah.
So we went over their archives, you read me everything, I'm happy with that. Now, maybe two last questions to end the interview and then we go with the upshots is can you just, like, if you were looking at me over there? Yeah, look good. Look good. Okay. So what is your goal or wish in this issue? Just to make like a kind of a conclusion about it.
Right. Well, my goal is to basically get people to focus on things that are real and to stop people focusing on things that are not real. So I would like people to really look at the evidence behind the chemtrail theory, and I would like them to question their assumptions. Is there actually any evidence for them to believe that contrails should not persist more than a few minutes? If people actually stop and think about it, and think about why they believe that. They're really just believing it because they read it on the internet. If they actually go and look in any book on science, or any book on the weather, like this book here is from 1980, and it tells you that contrails can persist for hours. There's older books from 1970 and 1960. They'll tell you the same thing. So I want people to look at things that are real and stop wasting time with things that are not real.
Would you like to say something else for the conclusion or something in general?
I think people should also look at geoengineering, because geoengineering is a real issue. It's something that we might want to do in the future. And I think people need to look at geoengineering for two reasons. One, if they understand the state of geoengineering right now, they will understand that it's in no state for people to be secretly trying it out. And if they look at geoengineering, I think it would give them a very good perspective on the state of the problems with the climate and the urgency with which we actually need to do things to fix the climate. And the best way of fixing the climate is not geoengineering, it's reducing carbon emissions.
Okay. That's it?
Yeah.
Good for me too.
Okay.
Now, we're gonna make some tough shots here. The first one is when we're gonna make you walk from there going